Hey there, and welcome to another special episode of UB Now. My name is Brian Biedenbach. I'm the Communications Director at the United Brethren National Office. And today, as you can see, I've got some guests with me. I've got Bishop Todd Fetters. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Brian.
Yeah, good to have you.
Thanks for pulling us together.
Done some of these in the past.
It feels familiar.
Yeah. We've got Frank Yang here with UB Global.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Good to have you. And David, Associate Director of UB Global, David Klein.
Also great to be here.
Today, we want to talk a little bit about a trip that the three of you took to the border. Mm-hmm. And I think you came back with some stories, came back with some insights that were valuable just for our staff here as you shared them, and trying to find a way to kind of share that with the broader United Brethren body. So we decided this would be a good way to do it. Mm-hmm. So let's dive into that trip a little bit. Tell us who you went with and why you went.
Yeah, because of our partnership with the National Association of Evangelicals, there's these immersive experiences that they will invite denominational leaders and other board members to. And so late last year, I got the invitation. I put it off, but then eventually I was contacted again. There was room available, and I asked if I could invite two of our colleagues from UB Global to join us. They said, absolutely. So I contacted David and Frank to see if they would be available. And I've learned to really value, appreciate, trust what NAE is bringing to us and what they're bringing us to. And in this particular case, it was a trip down to the Mexican border. And of course, that's been a controversial topic over the last several years. And, you know, a lot of times all you get is one side of things or one particular media outlet's perspective of things. And I wanted to see for my own eyes. And I wanted to also be able to process that. And so having David and Frank along ensured that I would process it. When I think of also why I wanted to go on this trip and why I wanted them to join me, you know, I tie everything as much as I can to our core values. And you and I have done a podcast before on our eight core values, and one of them is that we link with the larger church. Now, that could be other denominations. Also, it can be other organizations. And NAE is one of the broader evangelical organizations. I'm not talking about broader in the sense of, well, just broader in the sense that the evangelical church is expansive.
Sure.
And so with NAE, I've often and always viewed them as the gold standard for evangelicalism in the United States. I've valued our partnership. We as a denomination have been in partnership with them for about 70 years. So we've been good partners. And so linking with the larger church also allowed us to join a trip where there were denominational representatives from probably five or six other denominations.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was... that was awesome for us to experience that. Another one of the core values that this one was going to touch on was demonstrating social concern. And I've touched on that before, you know, on issues of race when we've had to we'll find our voice on that. And I thought that one touches this issue too about border and immigration. And just note here from our, from the, you know, some of the statements in our core value on this, that the poor, you know, identifying it with the poor will always be among us, can't ignore their plight. And the Bible clearly states our obligation to those living in poverty, but there are many others, whether they're poor or not, whose situations require our aid. And of that includes persons in prison, immigrants, widows, orphans, the unborn, persons with disabilities, the homeless, the elderly, and victims of abuse. So this trip was allowing me to live out one of those core values, or at least to learn how to live out these core values.
Yeah, I love the tie-in to the core values. If you're interested in those podcasts, right now they're living at For the Neighborhoods and Nations. Mm-hmm. You can dive in a little bit more and learn about those eight core values. Frank, what was, I know you were invited to tag along on this trip and be a part of it and be, not tag along, but, you know, be an intricate part of what they were doing and learning. What was your motivation for going?
Yeah, there are several, actually. Within UB churches in the U.S., we have a number of cross-cultural churches made up of immigrants from different places. And so in essence, it gives us a view of currently some of the immigration things that are going on. Also, it's strategic because we are starting to prepare two missionary family units to work in the U.S. within U.S. cities to reach unreached people groups there, like the Afghans. Mm. And so, again, this helps to inform our understanding of some of the processes that people go through to come into the nation. So it was perfect timing.
Yeah. David, how about you? What was your motivation for going to the border?
Yeah, when they asked me if I wanted to go or not, it was a personal one at first a little bit to me because I had a chance 2 years ago or 2.5 years ago to help an Afghan family move right here to Huntington, Indiana. And I recognized moving into that zone, I thought I knew a lot about immigration and refugees at that point. But then actually putting hands on, being a part of what's happening, seeing it with my own eyes, recognizing how the systems really work behind the scenes, a lot became much more clear to me. And also, I recognized sometimes there was a divide in what people really knew and what they thought they knew. And so when like as Frank mentioned, having people come to be working within our borders with unreached people, I want to understand kind of the under the hood perspective of what's really going on, not necessarily what I'm being fed or what is motivated by other realities, but motivated by my faith and what's going on there, and also motivating by good care for our missionaries here in the United States. And so, that just drove me to, I want to go see firsthand what's happening, what's really happening in the border. And that was really, really a helpful trip to understand some of those realities firsthand.
Yeah. And one of the things I've heard you guys talk about previously is the differences in some of the definitions of the folks that are crossing the border. Can you touch on that a little bit, Frank?
Absolutely. So there are three key categories perhaps that we'll touch on today. The first is immigrant. So I would be a great example of that. So I was 7 when my parents and I immigrated to this country, and my father was getting his master's and then later on his PhD in engineering in Florida. And so he went through a process by which he applied for a student visa and was accepted, and then we came. So that's one avenue. And you have people who are student visa and work visa here in the States. Mm-hmm. Another one, the one that we most commonly see referenced in the news, would be perhaps asylum seekers. So people who come to the border and who say, listen, because of gangs threatening my family back in my home country, I was forced to come here while you hear my case out. So asylum seeker would probably be the category that most of us think about when we hear about this topic. But let's keep in mind that's one category. Mm-hmm. There are more. And so the final one I want to mention would be refugees, which David referenced. And the probably best recent example would be the Afghan refugees, because as we may remember, after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, a lot of former Afghans who worked with the U.S. military, their lives and their families' lives were being threatened. And so for these folks, they went through UN vetting, and then they went through U.S. vetting, and also a lot of U.S. military personnel vouch for these folks. And so they were able to receive refugee status to come into the U.S. So those are three categories that's important to have some distinction around.
And I'll throw one more term in there, too. Just parolee is what those people are called once they're in that process. And again, parolee was always a term that was a prison term for me, and now it has a whole new meaning. So that's another term you'll hear thrown around in the news.
That's good.
Yeah. And so as I hear you talk, and we've talked previously about this, that the term asylum seeker is not one that I was familiar with, and yet that's the predominant story that we're hearing, which may be a different name or title associated with it. So. I think that's really interesting to perspective for me to have and for people that are listening or watching this. So there's a lot that happened while you were there. Like, you guys hit the ground running, right? And you went right to the border to see what was happening, and maybe unexpectedly getting off the bus or whatever. So what did you see while you were there, and what did you learn?
Yeah. You know, when you say we hit the ground running, I mean, we left here at like 3:30 in the morning to get to Indianapolis, to get on a plane, to land in Texas and McAllen, to get where we were. And, you know, by mid-afternoon, we found ourselves at the border at the wall, you know, something I had never seen in person, just something that I had seen on television or seen in pictures. Mm-hmm. And so here we are standing in front of what we know as, whether it's pejorative that we call it that or whatever, we're standing in front of the wall. Well, it's not like a solid wall. It's a slatted wall, more like louvers or more like, things that you would, blinds in your home that you would adjust. You can't adjust these, but when you do, you can still see through them. Mm-hmm. And at a different angle, you can't see through it, you know. But we learned that part of that seeing through it was also a protective measure to help border patrol be able to look through the wall to see if individuals are coming, and then to deal with them accordingly. We also learned that as we looked at that wall, again, what it's called, that really the border agents refer to it as a funnel, not a fence, not a wall, that much more the idea of that is that it's, you know, that language is the idea of separating, of keeping them out, or keeping people out, or keeping people in. It's much more of a funnel in respect to directing people to appropriate ports of entry or appropriate places of entry. And so right out of the gate, I'm learning a new vocabulary, and I'm learning newer and, in fact, maybe softer perspectives. Not soft in the sense that, you know, it's easy, but it's just maybe a little more tone of compassion.
Sure.
That, hey, there's appropriate ways to get in, and we just want you to find the appropriate opening for this. So that was our experience within 2 hours of landing in Texas.
Yeah, and that's not exactly what you expected, it
not
sounds
necessarily.
Like. Just right. You were there and in it immediately.
Okay. And to bounce off of what Todd said, I was shocked by the first time to see the fence. There were gaps in the fence, but there were intentionally gaps left there. And that was the part that I guess I really enjoy learning about was the Border Patrol agents. Mm-hmm. These gaps were left there because they're intending to have people have contact with this agency, this law enforcement agency that's designed to help protect our southern border. That's their matter of fact, not the southern border, all around the country, the border altogether. So it was just interesting to hear their tactics of how they do their job. You recognize that they're not necessarily swayed by the political winds of whatever's happening. They're just doing their job day in and day out. They have advanced systems. They have techniques. They also have some crazy obstacles with the border being partially water, you know, and then also partially private land and public land and all kinds of other tensions. But it seemed like they were doing a lot of grace with a lot of knowledge. They have, you know, really incredible technology as well. These cameras that can see license plates for 300 miles on, you know, blimps and things like that. I mean, just really cool stuff. But as a first responder, it also appealed to me because I recognize they're doing things not only in the law enforcement side of things, but they're also then turning humanitarian in just a moment's notice. Mm-hmm. That was something that was really, really compelling to talk to these people. So really, really a great time to learn. What I also learned was the cartels are a significant part of this whole conversation, more than I recognized before I went down. So that's something that was just really shocking to me with how they're faced with cartel interaction every day and how sad that is actually.
Yeah,
I remember when we heard from the Border Patrol, they were saying pretty much every person who goes through Mexico to get to the U.S., to the border like that, they have to go through the cartels. I mean, that was mind-blowing to me in terms of just how much influence and also probably revenue the cartel gets from all of this traffic coming up to the border. And to David's point, that's pretty sad, too.
Yeah.
I mean, I think for me, we met with a lot of incredible pastors and organizations, and you know, we decided, hey, this is not going to be a 3-hour conversation, right? So I would say the thing that I guess I want to highlight is we went across the border into Mexico, into the adjoining town, and we went to an encampment where it's these probably large fences, and a lot of asylum seekers are staying in there. Well, why are the fences there? There was a very intentional security system. You had to really check in and show ID to get in. Why? Well, because then the cartels would be extorting, and they would be doing things, and it's to keep people safe for the asylum seekers. Mm-hmm. And so when we went in this camp, I mean, just describing it, it's probably, I don't know, 1 or 2 football fields size, and there were a ton of tents. And these are not large tents. They're, you know, normal two-person camping tents. And you have entire families staying in these tents. So they've come from different places, South America, Central America, or even other places. And you have a family of four, let's say, with all their belongings. So, you know, maybe a piece of luggage or two and teddy bears, backpacks in the tent. And
the plush toys. There were just
a lot of
just
kids.
About every one of them. There's plush toys plush and lots of plush toys. It was interesting.
It was.
And well organized tents.
Yeah. And it's crazy to think, you know, it'd be fun to, as a family, do this for a couple of days. But some of these folks have been there for a few weeks and some even over a year.
Wow.
To live in this environment, there's porta potties, you know, in one section, and then there's a food portion in another section. I mean, this is not plush living, and there were men, women, children there in that encampment.
And shocked that encampment was only protected because of bribes paid to the cartel to leave that be a place of refuge and safety. So even when it's somewhat safe, there's that pending threat of the cartel just looming in the background all the time.
Yeah, it's incredible. And, you know, I think a lot of people were there because they formerly there was, I think it's called CBP1. Mm-hmm. There was an app by which it's a lottery system. So if I'm from, I'm just making it up, Honduras, and I made it up to that point so close to the border, I can try to, by lottery, schedule an appointment with a U.S. Agent or a judge to be able to plea my case. And so some people, they've been waiting this long because every day they're trying to get in by lottery and be able to get that appointment. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a lot of people, they're trying to find legal ways to be able to be at least considered for coming into the U.S.
Yeah. And that, so the initials you use for the app, CBP, is that Customs and
Bureau, Customs and Border Patrol.
And Border Patrol.
Yeah. Okay. Customs and Border Patrol 1, the CBP1 app. And as Frank said, that is something they were all, you know, through their cell phones trying to get in front of it, somebody who could hear their case.
Yeah. I remember it was pretty sad because there was someone there we met who had an appointment on January 21st. Mm-hmm. And come January 20th, from what we heard, the 8 a.m. Cases were all heard. So if I have an appointment at 8, I went to the border, you know, had a chance to do that. And then the 2 p.m. And onward were all canceled. So I can't imagine, you know, waiting there for months and then being so excited, I finally won the lottery and I'm able to go if it's January 21st or a week later, and suddenly, like, it's done. I have no opportunity and there's no other means for me to really legally have my case heard. And I know a number of people there, they were devastated because they had appointments that they finally got by lottery.
Yeah.
And when you look at the encampment, I mean, individuals have gotten there in a sense to be able to do this in a legal, correct manner. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I think it is sad. I think we're all impacted by the abruptness of that for them.
Yeah. So you started talking about some stories, right, of, you know, individuals whose maybe appointments were canceled. We talk a lot of facts so far, things we saw, things that we know or didn't know before. But I think the stories of people, real people that you met, make an impact. But tell me a story of someone that you encountered or something that you experienced while you were there.
Well, I could start. It was really striking to hear about a person who, for them, they're Christian, and they have avenues to try to cross illegally into the States. And she specifically said, you know, as a Christian, I want to do this the right way. I want to do this the God-honoring way. Even if it takes me, like, I can't get this lottery appointment, and now I have really no avenue. But she was saying, you know, even the cancellation of these appointments, I believe that it's God's will. Maybe it's not God's time for me to come across yet. And so it was really striking to me to see the faith of some of the believers who were there, that they wanted to, A, do this the right way in a God-honoring way, and B, had the faith to trust in God even when things were not going their way, even when they didn't see a path forward, they still had that faith and that hope. So, yeah, that was really instructive to me.
Yeah.
And that same day, I mean, it was the day we were in Mexico. We were at the asylum encampment. And I mean, it was just a poignant moment because that's where we interacted the most with people. And, you know, we were told that, you know, when we go in there, we're going to be, we were serving up pizza, mm-hmm. we were serving up juice, and we were working with a local pastor who has a ministry mm-hmm. among mm-hmm. Refugees, individuals seeking asylum mm-hmm. and ready to move in. And pastor was awesome. You know, there we are, we're out in the parking lot, and they hand us pizza boxes, they hand us juice boxes, we go in. The kids are going to get served first, and then the adults, if we have anything left over. And the kids came up, got their stuff. And then what we were going to do is pray for them. You know, for anyone who wanted us to pray for them, mm-hmm. we were just gathering them behind where we were serving. And I turned around and looked, and there were, you know, moms, dads, lots of kids there who just wanted to be prayed for. So we prayed for them, and I remember the prompt in my spirit. Having heard about the cartel, having heard about the challenges that a lot of these folks and the dangers mm-hmm. these folks might have encountered on their way here and beyond, I just remember feeling my heart pulled in the area of pray for the kids. Mm-hmm. Pray for the kids, for their protection, you know, of body, mind, and spirit. Mm-hmm. But then again, I also look at that from a perspective, and where I prayed for the parents in my spirit was, I can't imagine as a dad, you know, I would want the protection of my kids. So I became less pastoral in my praying and much more parental in my praying.
Mm-hmm. David?
I think for me, just watching individuals, and this is in lots of different cases, but watching the people who people spoke about just doing what they needed to do with the person in front of them. Mm-hmm. And I remember mm-hmm. one of the sisters at the Catholic Charities was just talking about that, now, mind you, the government there locally had asked for help because they didn't have solutions for a huge amount of immigrants coming in. She was very careful and cautious to go about through things through legal means and to understand these are people who've been processed with Border Patrol appropriately and taken care of. She had good best practice in her mission of saying, I can give help for only this much in this way. But she offered real solutions to the care solutions to that. That was inspiring to me because she was processing, you know, lots of people that no one else had an answer for. You know, as people continue to talk about this topic, she was actually seeing the person right in front of them. And that was very compelling to me to watch the sister do that. So,
yeah. You alluded to it a little bit earlier too, David, about when you were talking about Border Patrol. And what I found interesting and something you had said previously is the idea, being a first responder yourself, the fact that they can flip in a heartbeat you know, chasing somebody to actually giving someone care. Helping them on their journey one way or the other. Yeah. So, you have it, at least I do, and I think many people have it in their mind, like what it's like there.
Right.
And so hearing these stories, I think, make a difference. It changed my perspective just hearing you guys share. So thanks for that. I imagine being there, being someone here in Huntington, Indiana, going to the border, that you maybe a perspective in your mind of what you're going to see, what you're going to experience, and maybe it being just like that, maybe it being slightly different. But I wonder, based on what you experienced and maybe the ideas you had going in, what are some of the tensions that you now feel that are stronger than they were before, or maybe it's something new that you didn't expect?
Yeah, for me, I'd forgotten it, that we don't have to be only one-sided in our approach to things. I was early on faced with coming down to the wall and people saying, you know, the fence has not been built during the Biden administration. And I thought, that's strange. Why would you stop building a fence during the Biden administration? And then faced with the idea of there is no practical way right now to have asylum seekers come into the country because all those apps have been shut down and those pathways have been shut down. I'm not okay with that either. It allowed me to get some space to say, I don't have to assign or align myself with a political party. Matter of fact, I need to align myself with my maker, my king, mm-hmm. who gives me perspective, and I need to be choosing those. But those things are common sense those things need to happen. And I need to be thinking with that in mind, not with not with a political agenda in mind, but more so with the heart of Jesus in mind. And with and also as an American as well, I want these things to happen. I want those fences to be built because, just as we learned, they're very effective and useful to as tools to keep us safe and also bring people into our country we want here. So it's a it just was a reminder of me of stop thinking so binarily, but more so to ask these nuances, these difficult things. Let's talk about these. Let's think about these things.
Yeah. I found for me, just not in this situation specifically, but in a lot of situations, trying to think with the mind of Jesus causes a lot of tension,
it's tough, you know,
everyday relationships and everything, every situation. So I imagine that's difficult in there too.
It's not simple.
No, it's not simple. Pretty complex, actually.
Yeah. Right. I think for me, one of the more heart-wrenching parts is I never heard of the Darien Gap before. And this is a 100-mile portion near Panama between South America and Central America, where the terrain is so hard that literally they can't build roads there. And for a lot of these asylum seekers coming from South America, they have to pass through the Darien Gap. And first of all, you know, you're bringing your perhaps pregnant wife and kids, and you're trying to traverse this really hard terrain. And actually, on a regular basis, a good number of people die from falls or being swept away by the river. And so that's a reality that you face. And you're doing this with your family and all your stuff and your luggage. And then also, on top of that, there are gangs who prey on these folks. So literally, they're, you know, trying to extort people. There's kidnapping and human trafficking happens. They're doing terrible things to women and girls there. And it's this awful process they have to go through. And I remember one person shared with us that they talked to someone from Venezuela. And when they came through this area, they said it smelled like death because people do unfortunately die on a regular basis and are taken advantage of there. And what's worse is by the time they get to Mexico, some of the asylum seekers said it's worse than that, which blows my mind. Because then they have to deal with the cartels who do the same things. They're extorting them for money. They're kidnapping people. They're doing terrible things to women. We heard about the story of these people on a bus, and they were stopped by gangs. And they made all the women, girls get off. And they were doing terrible things to them in front of everyone. I mean, I just can't imagine as a dad with a teenage girl, as a husband, what that would feel like and how helpless you feel. And so I think to have a better understanding of what people go through to even get up to the border, it was really eye-opening. And so the tension in that is at the same time, you know, as an American citizen, I do feel like we can't just say, hey, everybody who wants to come into the States, come in the States, right? There needs to be good avenues. So therein also lies the tension that how do we have empathy for people and what they've experienced, what's forced them from their home, and also at the same time have good legal pathways? And unfortunately, this entire topic has become so politicized that there's just not good movement in immigration reform for many, many years, and there really needs to be.
So, Frank, it made me think, as you were talking and putting some of these stories together, folks that have come through the Darien Gap and then made it past the cartel and get to the border and don't get through what they have to face potentially to get back home because they've got to pass through those two places again. And so that's a tension that I feel now hearing these stories of, you know, what is it like for them who get turned away and to go back home. So, we could dig deeper into that. I don't think we need to here. But Todd, I'm curious, you had your motivation for going was our partnership with the NAE that you talked about, and just to get some perspective, but coming back as Bishop of the United Brethren in Christ denomination, what do you want UBs to understand from what you experienced and from this podcast?
So there's several different things that are coming into my head, and I'll touch on a few of them real quick. One is the United Brethren Church started out as an immigration movement, immigrant movement. German immigration or German immigrants is who we were. as a denomination. Now, that was not liked by certain politicians back then, because the big fear is that, oh, we're all going to talk German. Well, we didn't all talk German, and the church learned to adapt, and particularly the United Brethren Church learned to adapt to English, and our movement did fine. So there is that reality of our past. Second thing is, I love the fact that there's diversity reflected in our denomination. At one time, I counted around 20 or more different ethnic nationalities or citizenship, origins of citizenship, that were different than the United States, just in our denomination. You know, pastors who are from other countries, congregants who are from other countries. We've got Jamaican churches in the New York area. We've got Sierra Leonean churches in the Philadelphia area. So we are richer as a denomination because of the diversity that we have among us. And that shows up when you come to a national conference. Shameless plug for this summer. But
register
that,
now.
But that is what you see. And I'm grateful for you know, our Jamaican, our Sierra Leonean, our Hispanic brothers and sisters who help create that tapestry for us. The other thing that I would just simply want our brothers and sisters to know is that it's good to wrestle with biblical mandates and political preferences. That's a natural tension, because this is complex. There is more nuance to this than some want us to give credit to. But when you look at your political preferences, which are more fostered by whatever outlets or inputs you take in your news, or you take in your political perspectives, the Bible needs to be chief among that. And when I look at the scriptures, I recognize that, particularly in 1 Peter, Peter helps that church understand that you are aliens and strangers in a foreign land. This idea of heavenly citizenship makes us strangers and aliens here on earth. And we are a royal priesthood, he goes on to say, and a holy nation and a people belonging to God. Well, that aliens and strangers, or that strangers and foreigners language, really is echoing the Old Testament sentiments that came out of the laws of Leviticus and Exodus and those things, as the children of Israel were in and out of captivity, or as they were in that case forming, you know, as a people. And there's one passage in particular out of Leviticus that I think is important, and I'll just read it. Leviticus 19:13-34. This is one I think you just got to wrestle with. My preference versus the biblical mandate. Says, when an alien lives with you in your land, do not mistreat him. The alien must be treated as one of your native born. Love him as yourself, for you were aliens in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. And there's so many of those different verses in the Pentateuch where God ends it with this strong reminder: I am the Lord your God. Do this because I am the Lord your God. So God is asking us to be reflections, to recognize his authority and be reflections of him. Now, that's not saying that there aren't laws and perspectives that need to be respected. There are. This issue is complex. But please do not discount the biblical record, or do not allow political preference to unnecessarily eclipse the biblical mandate. Learn what God has to say in this regard.
Yeah. And that's a challenge, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's definitely a challenge. So it's a good challenge for us to wrestle with. Yeah. Frank, how about you?
Yeah, I think David said it earlier, you know, how do we treat the person right in front of us? Because a lot of us, we have a voice through our votes, but most of us, we're not making policy on immigration, right? And so how do we treat people in our neighborhoods? And I think, you know, the bishop said that well, in terms of we might have political leanings, we may be listening to certain voices on a regular basis, but as our citizenship is in a heavenly kingdom, what does our king ask us to do? How are we called to treat people around us? I mean, because that's kind of my own story too, right? Because coming to the U.S., our whole family like typical, a lot of Chinese, we were atheists. And how do we come to know the Lord? Well, it was because a local person got to know my mom and was able over time to share the gospel with her. And she prayed for me in faith. I had a heart disease. I was miraculously healed. And that was a catalyst for my mom coming to know the Lord, and then me, and then eventually the rest of my family. And I can't help but to marvel at how much that changed the entire trajectory of my family's life. And how, you know, gosh, I wouldn't be in the role I'm in right now, right, if I were an atheist. That's right. And so it's incredible to think, you know, when God puts people right in front of us in our own neighborhoods and communities, how are we treating them? What eyes are we seeing them with? Because you may be changing the trajectory of an entire person or family's life by the way that you engage with them. Just yesterday, I was reading in my devos, I think it was Luke 6, where Jesus, he's saying, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Now, this is, he's talking about enemies and people who hate us. I mean, typically, when we're looking at people from other cultures who are living in our communities, typically they're not our enemies, A, and B, they're not hating us, right? I mean, if we are called to even love our enemies and do good to people who hate us, how much more are we called to do that for people who don't? And so, it's just what an opportunity God has given us in our communities, in our workplaces, neighborhoods, schools, and how can we live as a citizen of heaven and allow the Holy Spirit to change and transform lives. That's just incredible for me when I think about that opportunity.
Yeah.
So good.
It, you know, it reminds me of, you know, the time Jesus was asked, what's the greatest commandment? And he says, love the Lord your God. And you talked about that, right? I am the Lord your God. Jesus says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And you talk about loving the person in front of you. That was the second. Love your neighbor as yourself. And it's that simple, and yet it's that difficult, because loving someone is hard, right? And but that's what we're called to do. So the command is simple, and then Jesus says, love as I have loved you. So, guys, thanks for sharing your experience, your trip to the border. I've learned a lot just from these conversations and preparation and here actually sitting here recording it. I know those who are watching, those who are listening to this later have may have some lessons they've learned, may have some questions. If you do have questions, let us know. Send them in the put them in the comments of wherever you're watching this video. Send your questions to us at the office. There's contact information at ub.org. We would love to hear from you. But the thing that, like, my takeaway from this whole conversation is this is not a simple issue. I heard words like complex, words like nuance, words like tension all throughout this conversation, and again in the prep leading up to it. So it's not an easy subject. We want to make everything really easy and simple, and we would love it if it was, but it's not. So again, appreciate you sharing your perspective and your experience at the border. That'll do it for this episode of UB Now.